You can't die in Svalbard. You can't be born either. Longyearbyen is a coal mining town whose mines have recently closed. It's the only permanent settlement in a Norwegian archipelago in the Arctic Circle called Svalbard, and is the northernmost town in the world. In Longyearbyen, an influx of scientists has begun replacing local miners, propping up a zombie economy with international research grants. Researchers arrive here in perfect irony to study the Anthropocene. As all the Arctic coal mined during since 1901 combusted, atmospheric carbon dioxide levels rose, and the glaciers whose tongues and feet and snouts had waxed and waned along the depressed arêtes of Svalbard for hundreds of thousands of years receded. Their mass balances shifted, they calved and let loose, and the temperatures rose, and the waters rose, unleashing a terrible positive feedback cycle. What will happen as these glaciers recede, as the climate warms, and as ecological catastrophe joins geopolitical catastrophe to make this and every other place precarious and unlivable? To find out, I flew to Longyearbyen. Less than 1,000 kilometers, from the North Pole, over 60% of Svalbard's landmass is covered by glaciers. Permafrost renders the ground nearly impenetrable. In the 18th century, Russian trappers would leave their dead above ground throughout the winter as the earth only softened enough to bury them in spring. And once a body is buried, Arctic temperatures keep it from decomposing. If buried above permafrost, as in the example above me, the thawing ground eventually forces bodies back up until they surface again. So the dead remain fresh, just below the frozen earth, perpetually waiting to be disinterred. I arrive in Svalbard at the end of February, when the sun hasn't risen for some time. In the polar circle, 4 months is spent in total darkness. For another 4 months, the midnight sun never sets. Technically, the sun rose a week ago, but at this time of the year, it never climbs above the mountains on the other side of the fjord. And so, there's a perpetual twilight, a prolonged late morning sunrise that gives way just an hour or two later to early afternoon sunset, staining the mountaintops pink. It's not overcast, really. The light is limpid and the sky is cloudless, but the sunless half-light makes every hour seem untimely. Now, the untimeliness of life is at the heart of my story, and while I will soon focus on life frozen, either naturally in the Arctic Circle or via technical means, I'd like to pause now to direct your attention to a different sort of resurrection. Indeed, I will now resurrect life, or attempt to. The Rose of Jericho is a plant native to the deserts in the Middle East, places like the Negev Desert, but also parts of Syria. And when desiccated, it can last for decades or even hundreds of years in a state of suspended animation. So for all intents and purposes, this is a plant that is dead. And that suspended animation is triggered by what is called programmed cell death, or apoptosis. But if you add water, to the roots of the Rose of Jericho, as the water soaks into its roots, proteins begin to hydrate, and they release substances from a dead seed coat. So as you can see, the plant gradually returns to life. this one having just been watered, think of this as a sort of time lapse. So this is the Rose of Jericho having been resurrected 0 hours ago. This was 2 hours ago, 4 hours ago, 8 hours ago, and 12 hours ago. Now, once the plant has been resurrected, it then releases new seeds into the desert, into what is called the seed sphere. And this plant has long been understood as a miraculous seed, one that is venerated by Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike. There's a reason why it's called the Rose of Jericho. It's also referred to as the resurrection plant. And it's used for many other purposes, from the occult to many early modern and medieval materia medica, as a treatment for various diseases and as a way of increasing fertility. But despite this long history of the Rose of Jericho, the reason why I bring it up now is that it is now being sequenced, and its genes are being synthesized by molecular biologists. The reason why they're doing so is because they hope that they can use the proteins and enzymes in the genome of the Rose of Jericho to protect crops against increasingly hostile global climates. The idea being that we could make new crops that will also have the same capacities that would be able to survive long periods of drought and then resurrect again. But let us return to the Arctic. I forgot that I had a time-lapse video that I was going to show you. Well, you can go on YouTube, just Google Rose of Jericho, and you can watch it too. Okay. So let us return to the Arctic. The cemetery is surprisingly hard to find. Three times, I mistake fields of wooden stumps for the cemetery. These narrow poles cant acutely from the ground, a kind of German expressionist gesture toward a cemetery. I later learn that these are the piles on which the original homes of Longyear City, what is now known as Longyearbyen, were built in 1906. German forces shelled and burned them during World War II, but they're still here. And the reason why they're still here is because since it doesn't thaw, water can't rot the wood. I nearly miss the actual cemetery, though, unable to see it until I'm already there. Rows of white wooden crosses, barely visible against the snow-covered mountainside. No one has been buried here lately. The highest row of gravestones mark the graves of seven miners who died of the so-called Spanish Lady, as the 1918 flu was then known. The very young and the very old are usually hit hardest by the flu. Yet World War I cultivated one of the deadliest viral strains in history. As young men marched across Europe, the so-called Spanish flu preferentially culled young adults. The results were devastating, a horror show of pandemic epidemiology clutching at the coattails of military maneuvers and socio-political ruin. On September 24, 1918, 69 young men, most of them fishermen or farmers, traveled on board the Forset from the Norwegian mainland to work Spitsbergen's coal mines. In the 3 days it took for them to sail from Tromsø to Longyearbyen, every last one of the passengers fell ill. Seven men died within weeks of their arrival on the archipelago, and the oldest of these was just 28 years old. Their deaths are recorded in the diaries kept by Stora Norske, which is the local coal company that had purchased Svalbard mines from the American-owned Arctic Coal Company 2 years prior. Stora Norske buried them here, on this stark and desolate hill overlooking a town that they would never see. Presumably to save money, their bodies were wrapped like fish in yesterday's newspapers. The bodies of the seven miners remained frozen beneath Plateberget Mountain for 80 years, until forensic pathologists and archaeologists, armed with new DNA sampling technologies, arrived in Lyngurbion to find out whether the flu virus that had felled them was still biding its time in the Arctic tundra. Researchers had already attempted to exhume victims of the 1918 flu in other parts of the Arctic and in Iceland. So as early as in 1951, microbiologists had traveled to Brevik Mission, which is near Nome, Alaska, to exhume the bodies from a mass grave of native Alaskan flu victims, though they were unsuccessful in those efforts. 50 years later, after exhuming 6 of the 7 bodies from Lyngurbion Cemetery, Canadian medical archaeologists sampled soft tissue using a boring device that had first been developed in forestry for taking tree core samples. So they used this boring device and inserted it directly into the corpses of the people who had arrived to mine the coal mines. This human tissue, of course, would have long since putrefied in bodies that had been buried in warmer ambient conditions. But in Lyngurbion Cemetery, the young men's corpses were desiccated and frozen solid. 100 samples of lung, liver, kidney, and brain were dissected from the bodies. And the genetic material of the 1918 flu virus, researchers found, was still there. Bits of ribonucleic acid, or RNA, fragmented and burrowed inside the bodies of these Norwegian fishermen. Further, the bacteria clinging to their lung tissue was also still alive, and researchers were able to cultivate it in the laboratory. It grew heartily in nutrient broth when it was heated to body temperature. 7 years after the bodies were exhumed in Svalbard, the genetic sequence of the so-called extinct virus was revived, not from the Svalbard samples, but from a different piece of human tissue that was kept frozen in a pathology laboratory in Washington, D.C. The sequence was then confirmed using the corpse of an indigenous Alaskan woman, again, one of the people who had been preserved in permafrost near Brevik Mission, Alaska, in a mass grave. So by that year, the entirety of the sequence of the 1918 flu was published in Nature and online. And researchers at the CDC in Atlanta, who resurrected the virus, then sprayed it into the noses of mice. All of the mice died within days. The Spanish lady's resurrection ignited a furor among biologists and ethicists who were horrified by how easy it was to revive this latent flu. They worried that a bioterrorist could easily download the sequence from a public database, and it was open to the public, that they could order the virus from a DNA synthesis company. As we learned, DNA is very cheap to buy online, and then that they could have it shipped back to them via FedEx. But what does it mean that newspapers and science journals report that we are now haunted, to use their language, by the specter of a virus that once lived, died, and was brought to life again? Attending to living things that can be arrested and revived reorients definitions of life away from the continuous unspooling of generations and living phenomena. So freezing does not simply pause, reverse, or restart biological time. Rather, freezing grafts the past onto the present in order to capacitate future life forms. So, I'm now going to resurrect my voice. One moment, please. My second story attends to a different sort of condensed vital potential awaiting resurrection, literal seeds. In 2003, the World Bank allocated $13.6 million to update 11 gene banks, which collectively held over 600,000 agricultural genetic resources. Mostly when I say genetic resources, I'm referring to land races. In 2005, just when the gene banks had been finally updated, Hurricane Katrina hit. And researchers began to wonder whether agricultural diversity could ever be secure in cities that were vulnerable to ecological disaster. They realized that gene banks were located in places that could be quickly dismantled by different kinds of geopolitical strife and natural disaster. Such gene banks included Nigeria, Colombia, and Nepal. Now, years earlier, Norwegian scientists suggested burying a gene bank here in a Longyearbyen coal mine. A vault dug into the permafrost in Svalbard suddenly seemed as safe a place as any, and perhaps safer than most. A thin cement wedge piercing the frozen mountainside at a steep incline, the vault's brutalist exterior suggests how deeply it is rooted beneath the earth. Above the doors and along the roof is an installation of prisms and fiber optic cables that reflect the midnight sun in the summer and glitter like the aurora borealis in the middle of the polar night. It looks like a science fictional post-apocalyptic bunker, which is, in fact, exactly what it is. At first, the Doomsday Vault seems to keep a kind of evangelical time. What I mean by that is millennial anticipation oscillates between apocalypse and salvation, with nothing in between. Millenarians either welcome Doomsday with open arms, or they stockpile beef jerky and Bitcoin, and sometimes they do both. The point is that the end is nigh, and the present has been reduced to a horizon in which to anticipate the end of days. This notion sounds somewhat like Walter Benjamin's point about perpetual catastrophe supplanting dialectical history. But more importantly, it is also the pervasive attitude of our times. Just turn on the news. The vault's engineers have prepared for a day when the permafrost has thawed. They've accounted for a 70-meter sea level rise, which is a rough estimate of what would happen if every single glacier in the world were to melt. They compounded that scenario with a tsunami, and then they built the vault 5 stories above that predicted waterline. Engineers calculate that given the current rate of climate change, the vault would remain below freezing, that is naturally below freezing, even if the electricity were out for the next 2 centuries. How long did you build it to last? I asked my guide. Essentially forever. So allow me to escort you deeper into the vault. The door to vault number 2 is overgrown with frost, which has crystallized around the door frame and bloomed across the door handle. My guide opens the door, and minus 18 degrees Celsius is a sucker punch. Yet here is abundant life, 860,000 different varieties of crops, and 120,000 different strains of rice alone. Seeds are sealed in triple-ply puncture-resistant vacuum packaging and are then loaded into plastic crates, which are stacked on shelves. Looking inside one box, I find ampules of squash and bags of anise. Every major crop in the world is in this room. Not just wheat, oats, barley, potatoes, lentils, soybeans, and alfalfa, but also heirloom seeds and forgotten landraces. Boxfuls of foraged grasses are stored cheek by jowl alongside sorghum, foxtail millet, burr clover, purple bush beans, pigeon peas, Kentucky bluegrass, and creeping beggarweed. Every country in the world is represented, as are several countries that no longer exist. Colombia, North Korea, Russia, Taiwan, Ukraine, Switzerland, Nigeria, Germany, Israel, Syria, Zimbabwe, Tajikistan, and Armenia share shelf space in this pastoral League of Nations. On February 26, 2008, the day the seed vault opened, Pakistan and Kenya were first in line to store their seeds. The previous year, the disputed election of Mwai Kibaki in Kenya triggered ethnic violence against the Kikuyus. Karachi had catastrophically flooded and was also seen to a bloody suicide bombing, and Benazir Bhutto was assassinated in the streets of Rawalpindi. Perhaps, for Kenya and Pakistan, a cache in the seed vault is a way to refuse political and climatological vulnerability, or even to forecast a future that might sustain life. I notice that one shelf of the vault is half empty. 4 years into the civil war and humanitarian crisis in Syria, violence barreling northwards toward Aleppo jeopardized the headquarters for the International Center for Agricultural Research in the Dry Areas, which is thankfully has an acronym, or it's called ICARDA. Hundreds of thousands of seeds were banked in ICARDA, including some of the earliest strains of Levantine wheat and durum, many of them more than 10,000 years old. Now, in an Aleppo summer, a power outage would thaw these seeds much faster than would one in Svalbard, so ICARDA shipped the seeds to Svalbard for safekeeping. The Syrian Gene Bank, now relocated to Morocco and Lebanon, recently requested 30,000 samples from its original collection to help rebuild the country's stores of barley, lentils, and chickpeas. Like the viruses that are thick on and under the ground in Svalbard, the vault condenses multiple temporalities. These are places in which some subcutaneous latent life, a virus, a seed, erupts into the present or is buried for future use. Coldness synthesizes and reassembles biological time. Following theorist Dipesh Chakrabarty, latent life in Svalbard is a sort of time knot that refers us to the plurality that inheres in the now, the lack of totality, the constant fragmentariness that constitutes one's present. The 1918 flu is a specter of the past that has erupted into our present. The seeds in the Svalbard Global Seed Vault are artifacts of our present that are now buried for future disinterral. I suggest that the temporalities in which things in the Arctic Circle move or don't move, and the speed at which they do or do not do so, is itself a principle by which things can transition from life to immortality. Some life is slower than molasses on a snow day. Some life is stuck in the past, and much of that old life is durable in its endurance, perpetually present in the present. It lags. It persists. Latent life promises to last forever, even as it is perpetually endangered. It can be patient as a saint. It can be quiet to the point of cryptic. This fact points us to the possibility that rather than being the common denominator underlying all living things, life is perpetually a problem of temporal discontinuities. Viruses and seeds that are stilled in states of suspended animation are classed as only problematically alive, but not quite dead yet. Biding their time, awaiting resurrection, they are pervaded nonetheless by a potent and vital potentiality.